On today's episode, we've got a cross-Florida trade. Echevarria goes to the Rays, and we're talking about the team's commitment to defense, the value of this Cuban shortstop, and whether we can readjust our projections of a front office like Tampa Bay's. Plus, we're covering all the big names like Schwarber, Urias. It's the DFA Podcast. And welcome to episode 14 of DFA, a podcast from Baseball Prospectus. I'm Brian Grosnick of BP, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, RJ Anderson. RJ, what's up, man?
Nothing is up, Brian. Nothing other than my anxiety levels.
Well, care to elaborate a little on that?
Not really.
All right.
I'm looking forward to talking about some transactions. It feels like it's been forever. It's only been, 8 days?
Yeah, it's been 7 or 8 days, so we got a lot to cover. We'll make Sean earn his paycheck, such as his, for the second half of the show when we cover.
We get paychecks?
But we'll torture Sean and make him read off lots and lots of transactions later in the show. But we'll start with our big move, and we have like a real trade of a real everyday position player. So we got something kind of fun to talk about today. So the big move is that the Miami Marlins have traded Adeni Echevarria to the Tampa Bay Rays, who ostensibly needed a full-time shortstop. The return was two minor league players, and RJ, you can just start us off by talking about why the Rays would make a move like this to add a shortstop without a whole lot of offensive capability.
Basically, it seems to boil down to them wanting a defensive boost at shortstop over Tim Beckham, Daniel Robertson, and, I mean, whoever else they would have thrown out there. I know that Matt Duffy's condition is sort of up in the air still, which is not exactly what you want to hear when you're trying to claim one of the wild card spots. So I guess they viewed Echevarria as a situation where they could essentially get positive arbitrage here. You know, they could get Echevarria for – pair of minor leaguers who nobody for the most part has heard of. I had heard of Braxton Lee. He's a pretty good athlete. Seems like he could go get it in center field. Probably not going to hit enough to get to the majors or at least be more than a reserve outfielder. You know, Ethan Clark was a draft pick in 2015, you know, well-built and all, but seemingly the Rays don't believe in his ability to start. So they basically got Echevarria for money, and I don't know. I guess it's better than having, you know, Taylor Feverston as your backup shortstop, or if they demote Robertson, you know, Echevarria makes sense slotting into their lineup as a shortstop. Beckham can move over to second base where he's a better defender, and on paper it makes some sense because, you know, they were a team playing with a complete makeshift middle infield. But Echevarria's name value, or let's put it this way, Echevarria is a bigger name than he is a talented ball player. So,
yeah, it's a kind of a weird deal in my opinion, because I've never been much of an Echevarria booster. I've kind of always thought that despite his reputation with the defense, which doesn't always reflect itself in advanced defensive metrics, he's a downright bad hitter. And he's never shown much improvement. This year, he's been injured for most of the season. He's actually injured right now and can't play immediately. He's in the middle of a rehab assignment, but he's expected to join the team this week. It's just kind of odd because the Rays haven't really seemed to care about shortstop defense in the past, have they?
No. In recent years, I mean, you can go back to the Escobar trade was the last time where they seemed to prioritize defense. Before that, they were playing Elliot Johnson of all people at shortstop. So, you know, I don't know. It used to be they always wanted a strong or at least average or better shortstop defender there. You know, Jason Bartlett, Reed Brignac. I mean, even Sean Rodriguez wasn't awful there. He just wasn't great. In the recent years, though, you're right. They tried Brad Miller there. They tried Nick Franklin. Oh, God, did they try Nick Franklin. and they settled on Matt Duffy slash Tim Beckham. They settled on Tim Beckham in Matt Duffy's absence. But it is unusual for them to go with a strong defender at shortstop to this extent. And it does make you wonder, is this a case where they just took the best available shortstop would have cost the least, or whether this is an example of them wanting to shore up their defense or being able to shore up their defense whenever they want in a game? I really don't know the answer to that. I don't know what their philosophy was there, but it is interesting, and it is a departure from their recent MO at that position.
Yeah, I think it's when I first saw this trade, I was like, this seems like a weird thing for a Rays team that doesn't tend to focus on shortstop defense to do. But the more I thought about it, the more I considered what you just said, that there just aren't a lot of shortstops available on the market right now, and they need a warm body, a guy who can go out there and play regularly once he's healthy. And so it may have been just an issue of he's a shortstop and we can get him and we don't have to pay very much for him. And, you know, if he works out, great. And if he doesn't work out, great. It just seems to be that there is quite a separation between how Echeverria is valued by some teams. There's quite a separation of how Echeverria is valued by some defensive systems. Like, for example, in Baseball Prospectus's metrics, he typically is about a 2 or 3 win shortstop. In Fangraph's metrics, he is barely replacement level, aside from one good season. You look at the Marlins, and a couple of years ago, the Marlins were talking about, hey, we're going to sign Echeverria to a long-term deal and make him a franchise building block, the same that they were talking about Christian Yelich and Giancarlo Stanton. And now it seemed like they traded him for pennies on the dollar. It's a really dramatic shift from a couple of years to how even the Marlins were viewing him, how other teams view him. It's just kind of surprising that one player, even in a world of all these advanced statistics, can have so many different opinions and people look at him differently.
I think it goes back to what we talked about maybe a month ago in terms of how defensive-only players are viewed versus offensive-only players, because if he were just a hitter, there'd be a lot less ambiguity about his value. Mm-hmm. But because he's just a defender, you mentioned those statistics. I'm looking at his BREF page right now, and since 2013, here's how BREF has valued his defense. -3, -3, 9, 9, and in 20 games a season, -1. You know, what do you make of that? Do you really think his performance has fluctuated that much? I kind of doubt it, but is he a 9 defender? Is he about average? Is he a little below average? The eye test suggests he is above average. I don't know if he's 9 runs. I don't know if he's just 7 runs or whatever. The Rays are very analytically inclined. I'm going to assume they're trusting their defensive metrics here because there's nothing else to trust. Like, he's not going to hit. The best case scenario here is he hits like 270, 275, and that would still make him a well below average hitter because he doesn't walk. He doesn't hit for power. He's drawn one walk all season. And yes, it's only 20 games, but like, some of us draw more walks in video games than this dude has so far this year. And yeah, there's just not a lot of offensive upside here, in my opinion. Is he going to get back to that 92 OPS plus level in 2015? Why would you believe that at this point? You know, he's just going to be, you know, he's just there for his glove, and that's fine, but he's not that great. As you mentioned, he's maybe a one-win player if you really buy into his defense.
Yeah, I don't know. It's tough to say. It's you look at his 2014 season defensively, and Baseball Prospectus gives him credit 9 runs to the positive. Fangraphs gives him 2 runs to the negative. I mean, granted, we all know that defensive metrics in one season samples are kind of crazy to begin with, but what you were saying about the eye test is definitely true. I do think from the eye test, from what little I know about scouting and watching a lifetime of baseball, he seems like an above average defender at shortstop. He's solid. He has good fundamentals. He may not have the range of some of the elite shortstops, but he looks like he can play out there. So I kind of err towards the side of he probably is a good defensive shortstop, even though I'm not an expert on it. But it's still so strange to think about how the Rays in particular value defense, because for me, this is a team that's always been kind of a black box in how they value defense. For years, they seem to have a fascination with having defense first baseman. And sometimes that defensive first baseman might not be a first baseman that the metrics say is a particularly valuable defensive first baseman. At other times, they seem like they almost entirely punt defense in different positions. The way they view catcher defense was a little bit maybe ahead of the curve at first. And all this kind of gets me to one thing I wanted to discuss briefly, which is the Rays are one of those teams that we always tend to look at as really analytically savvy and smart and ahead of the curve. And going and getting a player like Echeverria, who was on the Marlins, very analytically backward team for several seasons, it almost makes me think that maybe we need to readjust how we look at the Rays front office. Maybe they're not different from other teams in terms of their analytics anymore, or maybe their analytics are shifting a little bit, or I don't really know what's going on in the front office. And I think that's important for us to kind of realize every once in a while, is that the assumptions that we have about some of these teams' front offices may need to change a little bit more rapidly than us just assuming that, oh, the Rays or the Athletics are really doing things the way that they were when Jonah Carey or Michael Lewis was writing books about them.
Yeah, I don't know if they're smart, but I do know that they are very dependent on analytics still. And if you listen to some of the rumors, you know, maybe overly dependent on analytics. And I would just note there are some, let's say, additional benefits to getting Echeverria. Foremost, it keeps him away from the Orioles, who they're competing with for a wild card spot. So there's some, you know, old school, sort of old school baseball thinking there, in addition to whatever they saw in the numbers or in his tracking data or whatever they're using here. I really don't know. It's probably just some algorithm that said, yep, Echeverria is better than Zach Cozart. I mean, you know, It seems like they've had some issues with their algorithms these last few years. But, yeah, I really don't know. I don't know if it's time to change our perception of them. I do think they lost something that's hard to put your finger on when they lost Madden and when they lost Friedman and some of these other individuals. I mean, they lost Matt Arnold as well, and he was big on the player evaluation side. So I don't know. This is certainly an extension, though, to me at least, of their offseason when they added Malik Smith, they added Borges, they added, you know, even Colby Rasmus had a positive defensive reputation in the past. So it does seem like they still value defense to some extent, but it's changed in terms of perhaps how they view it. I don't know. Maybe they've shifted gears on how they view it, and those views are not necessarily reflected in the data we have, even if it is evident in the data they have. And I'm thinking really like the StatCast stuff. I could see them being a team that would be on the bleeding edge and maybe even be a little reckless just in search of that edge. Because, you know, I wrote that piece for CBS Sports early in the year on where teams get their data. And Vince Gennaro had this great quote about, you know, there are teams running simulations using the StatCast data again, you know, in their schedule and all this, and it sounds like ridiculous. It sounds like there's no way that a team can do that and get any kind of accurate results. But I was thinking, yeah, that's the Rays. Like, they're probably doing this. Yeah. They're probably doing all kinds of science experiments that do they work? The results the past few years suggest no. However, maybe they found something that helps them evaluate defense better than the other teams. Maybe they didn't. I don't know. I don't have any really good way of judging that, to be honest with you, because, you know, they were always near the top of the pack, or usually always near the top of the pack in defensive efficiency and all those numbers. So a return to that would not be out of character for them, but I think it's fair to say maybe they have changed how they evaluate defense, and maybe it's fair to say we have no bloody clue how they evaluate defense.
Yeah, I think that is a kind of a fair thing to say. Other than that, they seem to be trying to improve that as a team and improving their defensive efficiency. So this is a little bit of a hot takey question. What do you think? Do you think that this team is ready to claim that wild card spot? Because on paper, partially because of all these injuries, I don't think this lineup looks particularly scary right now. Yes, they are a pretty decent defensive team at this point, but is this enough for them to really fight it out with teams like the Orioles and the Red Sox and the Yankees and even probably the Mariners and the Angels out west to try to claim one of those wild card spots?
No, and I'm just going to focus on the bullpen here. because they don't have a good bullpen. They don't have a number of reliable arms they can really throw out there. I know Tommy Hunter has a shiny ERA. I know Chase Whitley has been pretty solid, but I mean, realistically, I don't like the bullpen. I don't trust their bullpen, and I don't think they have enough there in order to claim a wild card spot. You know, and you can talk about the injuries. You know, Rasmus is hurt, Kiermaier, Miller are all hurt, Weeks as well, although, you know, Trevor Plouffe's presence might actually trump Weeks and might push him off the roster. But yeah, I don't see enough here to feel comfortable saying, yeah, they're going to win the second wild card spot, because, I mean, you look at their offensive leaders, and they are Logan Morrison, Corey Dickerson, and Stephen Souza. And I like Dickerson a lot more than most people. You know, I thought he was almost like a Giants / Royals style hitter, but with a little more power. And I don't know. Do I really buy that he's going to continue to hit this well? No. Do I continue to buy that? Excuse me. Do I buy that Morrison and Souza are going to continue to perform this well? Not really.
No.
So, you know, if their numbers drop off, where does that leave the offense? You know, where is the rotation with? I know Snell's coming back, but is he going to be good or is he not going to be good again? And Free has been outstanding, but is this going to keep up?
Yeah,
I don't know. There's just too many question marks for me.
I think it's worth taking maybe just 30 seconds to talk about Jacob Faria, because he's been, you know, lights out. He and that changeup have been really, really good. It almost seems unfair that the Rays would have another kind of guy come up and flash some plus stuff and really be effective in a starting role. But man, he's looked good.
Yeah, and he's kind of like a James Shields, Alex Cobb type, in the sense that, you know, he's well built. Like, he looks like James Shields, basically. I think he even has number 34, which is one better than Shields. So, you know, he's got some arrogance to him, obviously. No, I'm sure he didn't pick his number. But the thing with Free is, like, that's a profile that's easy to sleep on, because it's like a 55 fastball. It's a plus changeup, but the breaking ball has always lagged. It's been closer to fringe or maybe even a little bit below that, depending on your source. And, you know, that's an easy profile to sleep on, because, you know, we always want to see three average or better pitchers or whatever from our starters, or we want to see two plus pitches and maybe like a 45 or whatever. And yeah, it's interesting because, you know, Jose De Leon is on the same organization, excuse me, in the same organization. They're kind of similar if you just look at the scouting grades, but I have way more confidence of Faria being a good MLB starting pitcher. And I know that's a really cowardly take to have, because yeah, he has like a 2 ERA through 4 starts and like a 6 strikeout to walk ratio, but he just seems like he knows how to pitch in a way that De Leon at this point does not. He knows how to sequence better. He knows how to use all of his pitches better. And yeah, when I watch him, I'm thinking James Shields, Alex Cobb, school of pitching. Like, he's going to be a dude who, he was a 10th rounder. Like, he wasn't even that hyped within the Rays system. I think he usually made like the top 10s at the very bottom. It was like 8th or 9th or, you know, some people were like, no, he's just a future reliever because the command's not there and the breaking ball's not there. But yeah, I think if you're looking for the next Shield / Cobb type in terms of unheralded random right-hander who shows up with good changeup and dominates in Tampa Bay, yeah, it's going to be Faria.
Yeah, it's fun to see those kinds of guys succeed. And, you know, if he goes fastball change and flashes the curve occasionally and then can do like Shields did and pitch backwards sometimes, I think, and especially with the benefits that you get from pitching in the trop, I think that could be a lot of fun for the Rays for 3 or 4 years until they get sick of him and trade him for more young players.
All right. It's better than the Myers trade did.
Hey, I don't think that would be hard. That's a low bar to clear, which is really bizarre to think about saying now compared to how we were 5 years ago. But so the Rays not doing quite enough to get over the hump. Hopefully they'll do something to address the bullpen or, you know, bring in another player. But we'll actually have a little bit more Rays talk when we get into the next segment of the show. So we'll bring on Sean and we'll start talking about some of the moves from the last week in baseball.
There have been a lot of moves. We're going to start in Chicago with Kyle Schwarber being sent down, because Schwarber has been just bad this season. They tried to lead off with him. Didn't work out. They moved him back down in the lineup. But I think the best way to phrase this is a quote from Michael Bauman's last piece. And he says, so here we are at the Have you tried turning it off and turning it back on? Part of shoulder reconstruction. So, have they tried turning it off
well,
and turning
I
it back on?
I think that this demotion to AAA is basically trying to hit the reset button on him, get some confidence up, get some reps against the type of cruddy pitching that he's always shown he can hit. So this is a nice little reset button. You gotta think that, boy, if we've hit the peak Schwarber this early in his career and it's all downhill from here, it really kind of changes the look of the Cubs outfield for the foreseeable future, because all of a sudden they actually have a weakness. We talked about this Cubs team as being kind of invincible coming into this season, but now if you look at kind of the totality of the Chicago outfield, it doesn't look so great anymore, which is really weird.
And I do think, though, that this is about signaling as much as anything. You know, this is a team that's underperformed all season long. Schwarber is very popular in that clubhouse. Sending him down kind of has two purposes. You know, one, to reset him, but also maybe to jolt the clubhouse alive and say, you know what, we have to perform, because no one is above, you know, no one is above a team. No one is above not performing well. And I think this is the unspoken reason why they did this at this point, to try and get everybody awake. I mean, you got to get going at some point, because they're not going to win a wild card spot without a significant push. And right now, last check, they were in second in that division. So the division's not even a given right now, you know? So, yeah, I think this serves two purposes: reset Schwarber and reset the clubhouse. Get everybody going.
I also think that a lot of this poor performance is probably driven by some BABIP issues and some just kind of looking at his plate discipline profile. It just looks like there's just been some issues where he seems to be, you know, making a little bit worse contact on balls outside of the zone. And so I don't really know. I mean, he's got a BABIP below 200. That's obviously partially due to the fact that he's not the most athletic guy in the world, but it's also completely unreasonable. He is still hitting for power. He is still being patient, and his strikeout rate hasn't gone crazy. So it probably is just going to be something where he's going to start mashing in Iowa, and then they're going to call him up in September or late August or something like that. And he's going to start hitting the cover off the ball, and it's going to be Cubs magic, and they're going to make their push for the wild card, and everybody's going to be terrified again, I think.
Last comment on this one, and you don't have to explain, just give me the answer. So at the big league level, who has a better line from this point forward? This season I'm talking about, Kyle Schwarber or Jason Hayward?
So if are we talking about – because if we're just talking about rate stats, I would probably say overall it's going to be Schwarber. But I think that it's not – cut and dried, and I think that Hayward is going to end up being the more valuable player from this point to the end of the season.
Fair enough.
Is it weird that Hayward has a similar line, and we think of Hayward as having a good season because of how bad he was last year?
I mean, yeah, but also there's the fact that, like, if Jason Hayward is hitting okay, he's a valuable player because of his defense. If Kyle Schwarber is hitting okay, he sucks. He's very bad.
Yes. Yep.
So I'll ask you one more before we shift off this topic. Were our expectations for Kyle Schwarber always a lot higher than they needed to be?
I mean, absolutely, because, I mean, but he did this to himself. I don't want to say he did this to himself, but, you know, coming back and performing the way he did in the World Series and even debuting the way he did, you know, he became sort of a, I would say, yeah, a fan favorite and sort of like the symbol of, I mean, the Cubs didn't trade him when he didn't really fit their roster because he was supposedly like this hitting savant, you know, this great clubhouse dude. And I really think we're going to look back and see that as a mistake on their part. Maybe an example where they were like feeling themselves maybe a little too much. And yeah, I think our standards are way too high for Schwarber. It was unrealistic to expect him to hit quite as well as he did in his rookie year going forward, let alone, you know, coming back and doing what he did in the World Series. And he was, like, realistically, he was always, or he had always shown platoon issues, and he's a good hitter. I'm not trying to take anything away from him, but is he, like, a top 10 hitter in the majors or whatever the numbers were a few seasons back? I would guess not, because I would guess not in most players, you know?
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I do think that the Cubs have always been very high on Schwarber. I mean, they drafted him fourth overall. I seem to recall at the time of the draft, that was kind of seen as a little bit of a reach. I think people were kind of surprised that the Cubs would go out and do that. And reportedly, they had scouting reports from internal guys saying that he was the next Babe Ruth and things like that. But it seemed like they've always been high on him. It seems like they've always been very positive about him. It seems like that carried over to everybody else after 2015. And maybe, just maybe, he was playing over his head a little bit, and he's not quite the phenom that everybody thought he would be. But because he plays in the big market, because he plays for the Cubs, because the Cubs were good all of a sudden, everybody bought into it as the standard rather than, this is him playing 20% over his true talent level, maybe.
Yeah, and he's easy to like, and he works hard, and it's a fun story. I mean, the next Babe Ruth thing, yeah, it's a fun story. It's easy to grab a hold of and hold on to, even if it's a little unrealistic and a little unfair to him.
So our next topic is going to be another struggling outfielder. This time it's one who hits the disabled list, Carlos Gonzalez for the Rockies. He's going to go on the 10-day DL, missed the last three games with an injury, and they ended up just putting him on the disabled list anyway. But the real topic here is not Gonzalez's injury. I wanted to talk to you all about how bad he has truly been since last All-Star break. And we always think of Gonzalez as a streaky guy, but it's been streak downward and nothing upward. If you had to guess his line, what do you think his slash since the last All-Star break was?
That's a tough question. I mean, I feel like it's got to have been bad. I know that this year he's barely hit above the Mendoza line. So if it's last year since the All-Star break, I'll just go with a simple 200, 300, 400.
I'll go with that too. That way we save time here.
It's 246, 313, 392, so you were close, right on it. But is there going to be a point this season where Carlos Gonzalez hits a hot streak and erases all of this bad
I'm
news
sure
that
he's
we
going to
have?
have a hot streak at some point, although you wouldn't know it based on like the past year production. But I think realistically, it's time to adjust our standards about Gonzalez too, because he hasn't been a well above average hitter since like 2013. His OPS pluses since then, 2014 it was 88, 2015 it was 116, 2016 is 110, this year it's 59. He's going to be a free agent after this year. I don't know if someone's going to bite and sign him to a deal that reflects upon his earlier career numbers, but I just don't think he is the hitter that he used to be. And I think maybe we're sort of letting his name value and the fact that he hit 40 home runs 2 seasons ago take away from the fact that, yeah, he's not quite that hitter anymore. At least if you go off the advanced metrics, maybe I'm missing something. And I mean, his line a few seasons ago was really pretty. Even last year is pretty to look at. 298, 350, 505, and that's with that horrible second half. So there's still offensive value here. I just don't think he's able to summon it over a full season anymore for whatever reasons. And it's probably because, he's 31 going on 32, and he's had a fair amount of injury issues throughout his career. So there's a valid explanation for it. But yeah, I just don't think he's quite as good as he used to be, and he's probably not this bad either. So that's a boring answer, but yeah.
Yeah, I like what you said about him being 31 going on 32. It feels like he's 31 going on like 36, given his
That's
skill
not how
set.
math works, Brian.
I know, but I obviously I don't care at all about math. I'm not a stats guy. But yeah, I just he's had so many of these issues physically. This is a shoulder strain. I wonder if there's another physical issue that's kind of been hampering him this season, because you can look and see how much his power is down. And when your power is as bad as his has been, and you play in Colorado, there's something really wrong here. And it does look like his exit velocity is rolling, average of exit velocity over on Baseball Savant doesn't look like it's very good. If he can't hit for power in Colorado, he's probably not a valuable ball player anywhere. And I would imagine he'll get a make good contract this offseason. It probably won't be with Colorado because I imagine they want to go a little bit younger, and they've got guys like Tapia and Desmond who they brought in, and David Dahl will eventually be back, we hope. So I think he's going to have to get a change of scenery, and hopefully it comes with a change in something physically that gets him to put the ball out of the park a little bit better.
So we now move to an injury further out west. Julio Urias is sent to the disabled list with a very scary pitcher injury. Brian, he reminded you
of
somebody?
It's a shoulder capsule injury. He's going to be out for a long period of time, probably 12, 14 months. And it's a lot like the type of injury that kind of changed the trajectory of Johan Santana's career. It's really disappointing. I really wanted to see Urias do well. There's been a lot of talk on social media about how the Dodgers have handled him, and we can talk a little bit about Andrew Friedman and what he said about this, but this is the type of injury. I mean, you hate to see somebody get UCL work done, get a Tommy John surgery. This is worse than that. It's a similar recovery time, but it tends to change a pitcher's stuff if they can even come back from it fully. So this is really disappointing. I really wanted to see him do well.
It's never a good thing when the best case scenario is Chris Young, and Young is the best case scenario for a complete and full recovery from the anterior capsule surgery. So, yeah, I hope he comes back strong, and I hope he comes back soon, but I was already very uncertain about what to make of him and his trajectory over the next few years, and this does not help clear anything up.
So we'll move forward now to two players being released from the Philadelphia Phillies, Michael Saunders and Jinmar Gomez, released. And which of these players is more likely to find a team and get some meaningful innings?
I'd say Saunders, because my assumption is that he's still dealing with knee issues. Maybe he takes a month off and it helps him, and then he lands on a contender's bench and goes from there. With Gomez, he's been so bad for his struggles date back to last season, and realistically, maybe he lands with the Nationals or whomever as a reclamation project, but I never was that high on him to begin with, whereas Saunders, at least I saw a decent to solid platoon guy. So, yeah, I'm going to go with Saunders. I don't know the likelihood of it happening, but I could see him latching on and having a decent end to the season to make up at least a little bit for his horrendous beginning to the year.
So I don't know. Both these guys have been so bad this year, it's really hard to imagine either of them being effective at all this season. I guess I'd agree with you about Saunders because he can at least hit for a little power still. He had six home runs this season. I mean, granted, the batting average has been awful and the overall line has been super, super bad. He's had no on-base percentage. But I think what you've said about him actually getting healthy might be effective. And if he's used properly in a platoon situation with a team, it's going to make him look a little bit better. I just don't know what kind of team really would go out and get him right now. It's tough to imagine because it seems like there's kind of a glut of available corner guys who can hit a little bit, and he doesn't necessarily seem like he's an easy fit for any team.
That's fair. But, I mean, injuries happen, and he'll probably get signed to a minor league deal. Something will shake out, and he'll find his way onto a roster is my guess. But I could be wrong. He could sit out the rest of the season, get healthy, take a minor league deal or a one-year deal during the winter, and try his luck again next season.
Maybe Oakland is a rehab option for him because they're running all sorts of weird dudes out in the outfield these days, Matt Olson, Jacob Brugman. Maybe that's a place where they'd pick him up and try to rehab his value a little bit.
The Oakland Athletics, home of the weird dudes.
Yeah, that's true.
So now we'll move out east to the Washington Nationals. They signed Francisco Rodriguez to a minor league deal after the Tigers released him. So I'll ask you all this. Why do the Nationals hate their bullpen?
Yeah, why would they love it? I don't think this is going to help too much. Rodriguez, he gave up – I mean, I just want to spell this out. He gave up 9 home runs and 25 in the third innings. That's literally 3 home runs plus per 9. That is insane. And I don't know that that's going to get much better, and I don't think he's going to make them much better. It wouldn't surprise me if he never makes an appearance in the major leagues for them, or if it's like a Jeremy Guthrie situation where he makes one or two appearances, allows another home run or two, and then gets unceremoniously dumped to end his career.
It's weird to think of Francisco Rodriguez as this type of pitcher now, and it's weird to think of him as kind of like a journeyman at this point in his career, but that's really what he is. I just don't understand what the Nationals are kind of thinking bringing in guys like Joe Nathan and Francisco Rodriguez, who are obviously past their prime, coming off a Detroit Tigers bullpen, which is notorious for being terrible, and thinking that's going to be some sort of stopgap solution. We talked about this last week, but they probably need to go out and do something a little bit more decisive. But I'm going to assume these are all guys that they feel like Dusty Baker would be comfortable trusting if they do bring them up because they have experience. It's just, unfortunately, experience isn't everything when you're giving up a homer every three innings.
So what is the hesitation to go out and get an actual meaningful good reliever, like any of the guys the Mets are probably willing to sell, like an Addison Reed or a Jerry Blevins, or even going to Pittsburgh and for Felipe Overo or Alex Colome in Tampa? But
there's a couple of good reasons against a couple of those teams. First of all, the Mets probably are not super pumped to part with their pitchers to the Nationals in the midst of a season where they're not completely done yet. So that probably makes some sense why you wouldn't see the Mets make a deal. The Pirates probably aren't too keen on trading Felipe Rivero back to the Nationals, where he pitched for last year. So I would imagine that's probably not a huge move. If the Nationals were willing to give him up as part of that Melanson trade, then they may not be real interested in bringing him back. I think relief pitchers are expensive. Like, if they wanted an elite guy, he's going to cost them. And if they want somebody who's not an elite guy, then that's why they went out and signed Joe Blanton. That's why they did some of the things that they did in the offseason. It's just a point where the Nationals probably are trying to decide whether or not they're willing to pay the going rate for a good relief pitcher, or if they feel like maybe it's one of those things where if we can make it to October, maybe we move one of our rotation guys into the bullpen and boom, we create a brilliant late inning pitcher for ourselves because we throw Gio Gonzalez at the back of the bullpen and things all of a sudden look better. It's just a tough thing to do. It's hard to build a bullpen.
I would just guess that the market hasn't really developed yet either because of the congested American League. You know, the NL, you probably have a few sellers now, but yeah, my guess is that we're going to see over the next few weeks a couple more teams will fall out of it, fade from the pack. Maybe it's the Oakland A's and they go out and get Ryan Madison or whomever. But yeah, that's just my guess that the market's not quite developed to the point where they're going to be able to land a reliever or two without paying a premium.
If the Rockies fall out of contention in a hurry, that's a team which, like, all of a sudden could really do some damage to the relief market by making guys like Holland and Ottavino available. But, you know, that would be kind of interesting for me to see because I think they'd match up well with a lot of teams, and then they could try to build more good young pieces to kind of drive towards 2018 or something. But so much of the Rockies' success early in the season was based on their bullpen, so I don't know how excited they'd be about being like, well, let's blow it up.
The Rockies, who have lost six straight, still hold a 6.5-game lead in the wild card, which is mind-blowing to me, that the Rockies had built up this big of a cushion at this early
season. Yeah, it's pretty wild. The Cubs are coming, though. They're going to get them.
So, going from one National League East team to another, the Mets placed Zach Wheeler on the 10-day disabled list, we got to see some more Rafael Montero, which we'll talk about in a second. But with Zach Wheeler, he had a stretch where he was really good. He was one of the best starters in that rotation for the Mets. And then he hit a stretch where he went 3 2/3 innings and let 15 earned runs up and gave up 5 home runs. And it really made you wonder if he was hurt, and then it comes out that he was hurt. What's Zach Wheeler going forward? Do we think he's that bad? Do we think that this is going to be what we see in his first season back fully from his Tommy John? What do we expect?
Well, RJ, I'll let you talk about Wheeler first because I feel like I'm a little too close to this right now.
No, go for it. I when it comes to the Mets, I just check out and let y'all two handle business. I just sit back
So
and enjoy.
you start Zach Wheeler out in the rotation at the beginning of the season, expecting him to be a full workload starting pitcher for as long as he'll hold out. And you want me to be surprised when there are some injury issues and he doesn't hold his effectiveness past the first month or month and a half of the season? Really? That's something we're supposed to be confused about? Like, this is so stupid to me. Why would they not manage his workload? I know that the team is driving towards a pennant, at least at the start of the season, but they had eight starters. And yes, eventually they all got injured, and now we're only left with Jacob deGrom and Rafael Montero and what's left of, Gesellman and Mattson Lugo, and that's fine and everything. It seems to me like in hindsight they should have taken a more balanced approach to Wheeler's workload. It doesn't surprise me that he would have some tendonitis in his bicep after, the first time he's pitched in major league action for an extended period for years. I don't think anybody should be surprised, especially when a Mets pitcher is injured. You shouldn't be surprised ever. But it's just one of those things that I think he will bounce back from fine over time. It's just that for this season, it's something that probably should have. We should have all been like, oh yeah, this was bound to happen at some point.
And it's a bicep injury too, which is worrisome for a guy that's had UCL problems. And you talk about his pitch workload. He went 80 pitches his first start of the year, 85 the next one, and then it was 99, 101, 96, 95. And it was really like, okay, we'll give him a couple starts where he'll only go a couple. And you did the 80, the 85, and then it was just boom, you're back up, fine, fully healthy, ramped up. And that was like, from his first start to the 99 pitches, it was 11 days. So it's a little curious to me that they thought he was immediately ready, because I believe it was in the offseason, there was rumor that he might have torn his UCL again. And it's just like you said, it's kind of odd that they didn't start him in the bullpen. And for any other team, it would be odd. But for the Mets, it is par
Yeah,
for the
and
course.
I have trouble being too critical of work pitcher workloads because, as we've seen with Urias, sometimes babying a pitcher doesn't work. As we've seen with other guys, sometimes giving him a bunch of innings is or pitches is actually somewhat beneficial to them. So, I'm not an expert on this sort of thing. I really am not. But it seemed so strange from the beginning. And because it's the Mets, you're not allowed to give the team the benefit of the doubt that they know how to handle pitcher injuries at all, because they've shown no demonstration in the past that they're able to do so. So if they didn't have such a trust issue with the team and with the way that they talk about injuries and the way that they handle them, then I think we would be in a little bit of a different situation. But also, maybe the Mets wouldn't have had seven starting pitchers on the disabled list this year. So yeah, I don't know. It's another disappointment. I really wanted to see him come back and pitch well all season long, but at the same time, it's time for him to go because Mattson Lugo are back and Robert Gesellman's still garbage. So yeah, I guess that's just kind of how things go.
And the two starts were against the Dodgers and the Cubs, and say what you will about the Cubs lineup, but it still has the potency of the Cubs lineup, like when it's good. But the thing we will move to now is the second end of this Wheeler injury. Now we're going to see Rafael Montero get some starts again, and I put in the recap that I wrote for BP Mets, everybody who has been around the Mets, who has watched the Mets, who has seen a Mets game and Rafael Montero in a uniform knows that Rafael Montero is not very good. But if you look at how he's pitched since he's come back, he's only let up 2 runs and struck out 15 in, I want to say, 12 innings of work. And it's going to be easy to sleep on that. I don't know if sleep on that, but it's going to be easy to see that and be like, well, it's Rafael Montero. That's just a freak stretch. And I wonder if it's just me being naive, or if Rafael Montero actually looked as good as he did with that slider and changeup towards the middle and later half of that start against the Giants, or if it was just the Giants and that's why he had a good start. reason to me,
I
right?
don't know. Rafael Montero defies reason. Here's the thing. When he made his five starts in the minors in Vegas, he pitched really well, actually, I think. His stats down there, and I can just talk about this from a stat perspective, because you better believe I'm not going to watch a Rafael Montero start in AAA. That's not something that is conducive to my mental health at all. But his start yesterday was good against the Giants, but just like you said, it's the Giants. And so this was his first win of the season. He's obviously got the strikeout numbers. His big issue has always been his command and control, which is weird because when he was coming up, he was always a command and control guy. But still, he's a nibbler. And so it always seems to me like he was fixable if he would just throw the ball over the stupid plate instead of trying to play on the corners, because that's what he was supposed to be good at and never really worked for him. I would not put any faith in Rafael Montero. He's done very little to prove that he deserves any sort of faith. And I think that it would be a mistake to try to assume that he's going to be good now. Could he be serviceable at the back end of a bullpen? Sure. He's not Tommy Malone or Adam Wilk or some of these other guys that the Mets have rolled out there simply because he can get some of these strikeouts and he's been pitching better recently. But I mean, I think we've learned our lesson about assuming that he's going to be okay.
You have to look at two. He started against the Giants. His next start is against the Philadelphia Phillies. So there's a good chance that we could see him go out and do this again. And then we're having more talks about, well, is Rafael Montero actually this bad? Is he just now figuring it out? Because in that start against the Giants, you could tell early on he was nibbling a lot. And he was missing spots by maybe a half inch to an inch. And then he started throwing that slider to lefties more, and it was working. And he was throwing the changeup, and it was working. And he was getting swings, and it's easy to like that stuff because it's a nice slider and it's a nice changeup and he's got a 95 mile an hour fastball. But like you said, this is still the guy who nibbles, and you wonder how long it'll be until he goes back to being Rafael Montero of old.
Yeah.
RJ, do you have anything?
Nope. Got nothing.
Relax. The one good thing about the Phillies when he's going to pitch against them is the Phillies basically don't have any left-handed hitters, and lefties have eaten him up this year, and righties he's been mostly okay, aside from the walks. But he's okay against righties. So as long as they keep pitching him against, the Phillies, then, yeah, things should probably go okay.
We now move back to the Tampa Bay Rays, who we talked about earlier in the show. Feels like it was forever ago, but we now see the Rays have released Derek Norris and activated Wilson Ramos from the disabled list. Also, one of y'all wanted to talk about a Chris Jimenez?
Go for it, Ryan. He is all yours.
So all these guys are kind of interesting Rays or former Rays catchers. Let's just go over the Rays stuff first. The Ramos signing was, everybody was like, hey, good job, Rays. You did a great job signing this guy, even though he may not be able to catch or do much for the first half of this season. Derek Norris was an unmitigated disaster for this team and for, like, it appears, potentially other people in his life. So it was smart of the Rays to cut ties with him and move on as soon as they could. As far as Ramos goes, he's going to be an upgrade for their offense. It's good to see him back and playing. It'll be a kind of an open question to see how much he can play this year, but he's really the kind of, in-season impact acquisition that the team is probably looking for, that every team wants to have this point in June. So I'm really hoping to see him play well, hit for some power, and show that 2016 wasn't a complete fluke.
Yeah, and like you said, it's a boost to them, potentially offensively, maybe even defensively, if you believe Ramos's reputation. And I want to talk about Chris Jimenez, so let's talk about Chris Jimenez.
Well, this whole thing is just an excuse to talk about Chris Jimenez, which is perfectly fair. So Chris Jimenez got his first home run of the season, or not his first home run of the season, excuse me, but he hit a home run last night as the Twins lost to Boston. Chris Jimenez is secretly the guy that we were hoping Christian Betancourt would be this year. Like, he Betancourt got all the talk at the beginning of the season. Oh, the Padres are going to use him as a catcher and as a pitcher. And like, real quietly, Jimenez has thrown six, has made six appearances for the Twins and thrown five innings, which is it's bizarre and crazy and wonderful. And so I just would like to point out how great he's been. Even though he's been a bad pitcher, he's picked up some of those garbage innings and he's been hitting better than average. So is there anything this guy can't do?
Nope. He's going to be a future manager. He's very intelligent and thoughtful about the game. And that's my guess that in 10, maybe 15 years, we'll be talking about blank manager Chris Jimenez.
Yeah, maybe he'll take over for Francona in Cleveland. They definitely liked him a lot in the Cleveland organization. Maybe he'll be managing the Rangers. Who knows? But he's a fun guy to see. And so, RJ, you were telling me before that he also has another skill.
He is the most effective shapeshifter in baseball because whenever there's a brawl, he grows to like 6'8", 6'9". He towers over everyone, even though his listed height is around 6'2".
So, I mean, is there anything this guy can't do? He's part pitcher, part catcher, part manager, and part the Incredible Hulk. So, good on him. I'm just really looking forward to seeing him continue to do weird stuff. Do you want to give me an over-under for how many pitching appearances he'll make this season?
So, we're talking about total, or are we talking from this point forward?
I'm talking about total, his season pitching appearances.
We're about halfway through. Let's assume the Twins are a little worse heading forward, so... let's go with 15.
15? Can you believe that? A guy who's supposed to be like the backup catcher getting 15 appearances and throwing like...
I mean, that might be that might be a little too aggressive, but...
15! It's incredibly handy. Aggressive, and I handy. Love it. I love
yeah, it's
it. It just makes me really disappointed that some team isn't using Drew Butera like this, because Butera is an actual like good pitcher, and I don't think he's gotten a chance to get into a game this year for the Royals. I just want to check real quick. No, he got into two games last year and two games in 2014 with the Dodgers, but hasn't gotten into a game as a pitcher yet this season.
Plus he's handsome, so the close-ups would be refreshing.
Oh,
and
yeah.
A late blowout. Yes. Like if you're watching a game when the backup pitcher is on the mound, the backup catcher is pitching, you deserve some close ins of a handsome dude, So that's just a nice little byproduct of a blowout is seeing Drew Butera pitch.
So that was our sneaky Chris Jimenez segment. We'll move on to actual transactions now.
And actual transactions, this one kind of manifests as one, but Yankees DFA Chris Carter. The Yankees have been really good this year. They've had good play from a lot of guys that I don't think they knew were ready or I thought they were ready, like Aaron Judge or Aaron Hicks or anyone named Aaron in the Northeast. But what
he's
happened
bad.
With Chris Carter?
It turns out he can't field, so he's dependent
Surprise.
On his bat. And when we're in late June and his numbers are where they are and he doesn't really fit that roster too well at this point, so... of course, DFA him, get Tyler Austin up, see what he's got to offer. Best case, Austin's better. Worst case, he's about the same. So it makes sense to me.
Yeah, I agree. This is the first season where he's ever been a below average hitter, really. And Chris Carter is a below average hitter, is a far below average baseball player.
His power is a minor leaguer. Carter is a below average hitter, is a minor leaguer, or not employed whatsoever.
Right. And so, he's got to be hitting 30-ish home runs to be effective, and he's been nowhere near that. It is kind of weird to see that now all of a sudden the Yankees kind of don't have a first baseman because they had Greg Bird, and he was bad, and they had Matt Holliday, and now he's injured. And Chris Carter, who also can't play first base, but it's kind of interesting. They could really be a team who could use somebody before the end of July, make a move for a first baseman, get somebody a little bit more consistent in that position as well.
Perhaps Yonder Alonso, which would transition well to our next move, I believe, Brody.
Smart man.
Absolutely, and I'll just add one more thing to Chris Carter before we bounce off of that, and that's, I know he was DFA'd, so that means he doesn't have to leave the Yankees, but if he does, I'm going to point him towards the direction of Colorado. still going to prod him that way. We'll move forward now to the Athletics. And they called up Franklin Barreto, one of their top prospects. Believe he came over in
Josh
one of their
Allison
big
trade.
trades, the Josh Donaldson trade. And what do we expect
Disappointment.
From Barreto?
You mentioned him as the Josh Donaldson trade, and you sort of get your eyes bugging and all, but he's young. I don't know. There's just no kind way to say this, but in Triple A this season, and again, he's young. He's 21. He hit 281, 326, 428. That's in the PCL, and that's an ugly walk to strikeout rate and a very un-Oakland-like walk to strikeout rate. So I'm willing to give him some benefit of the doubt because of his age and because he can play up the middle. But realistically, he's not going to be superstar or star-level player most likely, and that's okay. We'll just see if he's on the right side of average, because ultimately that's going to determine whether he's a starter or if they're just going to have a bench player here, albeit a really young one. I mean, I don't know. Ryan, are you more optimistic about him than I am, just based on what I said?
It's tough to say. When he was going to be a shortstop, the bar was a little bit lower that he would have to clear offensively.
Yeah.
He did look like when the Josh Donaldson trade happened, he was a top-tier looking prospect. And I think now he's definitely got a lower ceiling than what we would have once imagined for him. I do think it's still possible. I mean, look at his line in Double A last year,
yeah.
And it was very good. He has speed. He didn't have the strikeout issues that he has this year in Triple A, and he was a, like you said, he's very young. He's 21. He's making his major league debut at the age of 21, so there is room for him to work on his approach. I think that there's something that he can improve. Chris Mitchell over at Fangraphs threw some comps. Using his Kato system, which, take it for whatever that's worth. But the guys who came up as comps for him were not all that wonderful. The guys you would hope that come out of that are guys like Carlos Guillen, Johnny Peralta, Trevor Plouffe, and then Reed Brignac. That's not really what they were hoping for when they traded for him. They kind of expected somebody who would be, good hit tool, a little bit of power, could stick at shortstop, and you're seeing a lot of guys who their overall offensive abilities really took a leap forward, but they played positions like second, third, a little bit of shortstop, maybe some outfield, weren't all that impressive defensively. So I have a feeling he's going to end up being like a second division starter or a good utility guy, and all they had to give up for that was Josh Donaldson.
Whatever happened to Josh Donaldson? Because I feel like I won't hear from him anymore.
He had injury problems.
Too bad.
To start the year, and yeah, it was. He's still not.
Oh well. Wow.
Yeah, one.
I'm sure the A's won that trade. So.
back to Barreto. He came up for Chad Pinder, who was placed on the 10-day disabled list with a left hamstring injury. It's questionable whether Barreto is going to stay once Pinder comes back, but you'd have to think that whenever Jed Lowrie is going to be traded, assuming he isn't hurt terribly with his knee thing, that Barreto is going to be the second baseman going forward post-Jed Lowrie.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I definitely think they would get some value about by sending him back to AAA. But the thing about Barreto is he has in his first two games, I mean, he did go yard once already. So it's, his rate stats are all like, crazy for the two games. So it's one of those things where if he winds up, continuing to play really well for a short span, then he could wind up sticking around. But I think he would benefit from more seasoning in AAA, getting used to taking a big league approach against some better breaking pitches. But I mean, who knows?
So we'll go from a current Athletics team to a player who used to be on the Oakland Athletics. That's Stephen Vogt. He was claimed off waivers by the Brewers. And I wanted to read one quote to y'all. It's from Eric Sogard, who is apparently the Brewers infielder and best hitter in the nation. He said, "He works hard, comes to battle every day, a great teammate and all-around person. They're clearing house and going young, so it's their loss and our gain." Do we think that Vogt fits in well with this Brewers team, especially with Eric Sogard, a former best friend, it seems like?
He's all right. I mean, he's not going to Like his best hope is to reinvent himself as a professional pinch hitter who can occasionally stand at first base or in left field. Not really a catcher, not even that great of a hitter. You know, there was always going to be a thin margin of error for him. So yeah, I think this is fine going to a National League and coming off the bench, getting his plate appearance or two a night, and that's about all she's going to write out of Stephen Vogt's career if he's not capable of making this transition, because he doesn't really offer a whole lot else.
Yeah, it's do you think it's weird that he has been an all-star for the last two seasons?
Yes, I have. I mean, yeah, I saw I had to write it. Wow, I can't. I'm so tongue-tied about that one. Yeah, I do think it's weird, but remember, Matt Wieters was an all-star last season too, and his numbers didn't really reflect it. So it's kind of a it was kind of a weak year for catchers in the American League, if my memory serves me correctly. Also, I would add this about Vogt. We talked about Jimenez earlier and how he's a great clubhouse guy and a future manager. Vogt could be that too. He is well regarded in the clubhouse.
Yeah, and that's something that's probably extra valuable for this Brewers team, which is considered a young team, but they're also striving to, you know, improve in a hurry and maybe in the playoff hunt this year. So that's probably that clubhouse aspect is probably really helpful to them. But the Brewers catching situation is pretty ugly, right? I mean, they just sent down Jett Bandy to make room for Vogt. Manny Pena's starter. It's not necessarily what you want to see for a team that's going to be supposed to be competing. So maybe they're hoping that Vogt will give them that kind of offensive boost and maybe play more like an all-star as the season goes on. You know, they could really use somebody like, I don't know, Jonathan Lucroy.
Never. I thought you were going to say Andrew Susak, but he's not even hitting in the minors. So
no, I mean, I thought Susak was going to be great. I was way wrong.
So now out to Houston, another pitcher coming off the disabled list, Lance McCullers Jr. And so what do we expect from him going forward? He was really good to start the year, kind of struggled in the middle, but do we think that he's back to being Lance McCullers that we have come to?
I think that is Lance McCullers. He's a little up, a little down, good stuff. You know, there's a reason that teams weren't necessarily sold on him as a starting pitcher, and some of that just has to do with consistency. So I think this is him. I think he's going to be up, give you a couple good starts, then maybe a bad one or two. It's almost reminiscent of Scott Kazmir a few years back, and I don't know why I made that connection in my head, but I did. You know, just, I don't know, I think that's him. I think he's a good pitcher. I just don't think he's necessarily going to take that step forward where he's a great pitcher who's, you know, consistent every single time out, at least not yet. Maybe in a year or so we're talking about him as one of those pitchers. But yeah, I think that's him. I think, you know, up and down, up and down, with more ups than downs, obviously.
So I will take a slightly different view than you are, Jay. I think he is a legit two and possibly closer to a one. The issue that I have with McCullers is it's exactly like you say. He has up games, he has down games, but his up games are so good and his down games are infrequent enough that from a performance standpoint, I really see him as a two, and the reason I don't see him as a one is because I do have some concern that his reliance on the curveball and the injury issues that he's kind of had in the past are going to keep him from putting up the number of innings to be a one. And so, you know, if he was up and down, but he was throwing 180, 200 games a season, he'd be a top five Cy Young pitcher in the American League. I don't think there's any question of that. I do think that between I don't know why. Maybe there's no real data to kind of support this, but after watching Rich Hill and, you know, his success with the curveball and how frequently he throws, and then McCullers throwing it so frequently, I wonder if that's something that's going to continue to foment some injury issues, and I wonder if that's something that's going to foment some consistency issues. But I definitely think that he's good enough in terms of his performance that as long as he stays healthy, the Astros have a guy who can go out there any game and just put up a goose egg.
I agree with that. I guess I was just thinking, and you know, if you look at his game logs, the inconsistency issues we're talking about are probably overblown to some extent, at least, because these are his runs allowed by game. I'm going to read all 14 just to give you an impression. So it was 1-3-5-0-5-2-1-0-0-0-3-4-1-1. So out of 14 starts, he's given up three runs or more five times, and he's given up more than three runs three times. So that's No, that's pretty good. Maybe I was overstating the inconsistency a little bit, because you're right. Purely statistical basis, he is at least a number two, maybe a little more. I do not call anyone who has not thrown 200 innings in a season an ace, just because, like you mentioned, that's a big part of it. You know, you have to be able to handle the workload, handle 30 plus starts a season. And I realize that maybe teams are getting away from that to some extent, especially with guys like McCullers, who are younger, who are as reliant upon their breaking stuff as he is. But that's just my rule of thumb at this point. And yeah, I think we're basically agreeing here. I probably overstated the inconsistency issues a little bit. And to his credit, he's really cut into his walk rate. It's literally half of what it was last season, when it looked like maybe he was a little too wild to be a successful starter long term. So credit to him. And credit to the Astros pitching coach and pitching development staffs for not only sticking with him now, but sticking with him as a amateur. Because, again, teams were not necessarily sold that he was going to be a starting pitcher in the majors.
Yeah, that's for sure. And he may not be forever. I mean, sure, he does have some issues going deep into games. But just to throw out a couple more numbers, since you were reading some numbers before, I'd like to read to you his strikeout totals per game. And they're basically a million, a million, a million, a million five, a million. You get the idea. And then for homers, he gave up six homers so far this season, but four of them were in his first three games. Yeah. So it's one of those things where he does seem to be improving at different points in the season. It's just one of those things where he's just going to need to put in three more years of throwing, you know, consistently going deeper into games. He's only pitched seven innings or more. Well, actually just seven innings. That's the most he's pitched this year, three times. Yeah. And that's not even really a negative. It's just something that, when we look at kind of categorizing pitchers, that's what helps keep him out of the ace bucket for me.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the Kazmir thing, the Kazmir comparison I mentioned earlier, because his pitch count has been there. I know you talked about, you know, he's only thrown seven innings three times, but if you look at his pitch count alone, he has topped 90 in all but three of those starts. He's topped 100 three times, and in those games, he did not reach the seven-inning mark. So just goes to show you, even though he throws strikes and misses bats, there's still some efficiency issues there that need to be ironed out if he's going to take that next step, if he's going to top 200 innings or whatever your threshold is to call him an ace, or if he's going to prove it. Yeah, he's a starter long term, and this isn't just, you know, the first phase of his career.
So if you look at his season last year, dude walked a bunch and he had a high BABIP, but he still had a 3.22 ERA. And I've always thought that was amazing. I think I actually wrote about that last year, that it's so weird that a guy can carry a high batting average balls in play, a high K9, and a high walk 9, and still just have a sterling.
Miss bats, and that's what happens.
And the fact that he also combines missing bats with a ground ball rate that's like almost like Dallas Keuchel. And when that happens, you know, you can afford the mistakes of walking a guy, because you're either going to strike him out to get out of it, or you're going to put the ball on the ground and you know, be able to get a guy to ground into a double play. So, I mean, he's kind of the total package in the format that he's pitching right now, just, you know, without the health consistency or quite the number of innings, the efficiency, which I think you really get to, RJ, there. That's the point, is more the efficiency, and it's hard to be efficient when you strike out eight guys a game because you're throwing a lot of pitches to get those strikeouts.
So we have two center fielder injuries for y'all to dissect. It's the Cardinals placing Dexter Fowler on the DL with a heel injury, and Aaron Hicks going to the DL for the New York Yankees. Jacoby Ellsbury also came off, but my question for you is, which of these center fielders will play better down the stretch, Aaron Hicks or Dexter Fowler? And it really comes down to whether you believe in Aaron Hicks or you believe Dexter Fowler.
I believe in Fowler more than I believe in Hicks.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think we have a whole lot more solid performance in the history of Dexter Fowler than in Aaron Hicks. When did anybody think that Aaron Hicks would hit this well ever? I don't think anybody ever did. Whereas with Dexter Fowler, I think we all assume that he can play well, but he may hit a downstretch, right?
So I think this is the funny thing too, okay? This is obviously Hicks' second season in New York. He's hitting 290, 398, .515 right now, and yet you want to guess what his career OPS plus with the Yankees is? Like, this will tell you how bad last season was for him, if you can guess this correctly.
I'll go with like 100.
Nope. Brody, you want to throw a guess out here? Keep in mind, he has a 137 OPS plus this season.
I'm going to go... Yeah. It was bad. He was very bad.
Y'all about split the difference. It was 93. So, yeah, he was horrendous last year. He was actually worse with the Twins throughout his career, save for 2015 when he looked like a solid platoon player. So, yeah, I kind of hope Hicks is legit because that's a fun story. But if I were selecting one player or the other for my team, I'm going with Dexter Fowler. And he's going to probably top his career high in home runs this season, which is interesting. I don't think I expected that from Fowler. But, yeah, I'm going with Fowler.
Yeah, and the other thing about Fowler is that he hasn't been bad this season. He hasn't been as good as he was last year with the Cubs, but he hasn't been
bad. Who has been as good as they were last year?
The thing about Hicks is, can we talk about juice baseballs for like just a second? Like, because Hicks's improvement is, and it's partially driven by his walk rate, but I think his walk rate is partially driven by the fact that now he is a legitimate power threat, and he's another one of those guys who is could be benefiting from not quite home run balls, like that would be nice little flyouts to the right fielder in Yankee Stadium before being, oh, guess what? It went over the fence and now it's a home run and he's got an over 500 slugging percentage. So I think that maybe this is part of this increase in home runs across the board and it's affecting him. So I wouldn't even is it weird that I don't want to give all the credit for his improvement to him, that I want to give it to something of kind of the changing landscape of baseball right now? I mean, obviously he deserves most of the credit, but I feel like this is one of those kind of accidental things that just kind of come about when you have changes in the nature of baseball.
Yeah. I really don't know how to divvy that up either, but I guess I'm inclined to still give the player credit because, you know, it's still the player making contact with the baseball, still the player, you know, taking the balls, swinging at strikes and whatnot. But you're right, that is a little bit more complicated than it should be given how we usually approach this, you know?
And just the other thing that I'll throw out there when we talk about his walk rate is that he's not getting intentionally walked, so that's not what it is. But pitchers are throwing balls in the zone a little less frequently to him this year. So, and he's being smart. He's laying off them more as pitchers kind of avoid the zone more. So that's obviously an improvement at his point. But one of those things that we usually see, like kind of as the canary in the coal mine, is that if pitchers start dealing a lot differently with a hitter, it usually means that there's been some sort of change, that they look at him differently and maybe the true talent level has changed. So that's kind of a sign that perhaps his true talent level has changed a bit as well. It's just, I think that maybe the contextual factors make a big difference as well.
Well, back to the juice ball. This is the problem that MLB has to deal with, right? Because if the ball is juiced and they haven't addressed it, they haven't said anything to anybody, and they're trying to – they sent that report out that said – trying to say it wasn't. And if they're doing this much to say it's not, then they're going to have people question whether their players are actually that good, whether they're doing it because of PEDs, whether they're doing it because the ball is juiced and they're hiding it. It makes you question authenticity of hitters because you don't know. But in reality, it would just probably be the equivalent of making the league play in Coors, right? I mean, am I off?
Well, I don't really know. So I'm kind of a juiced baseball agnostic. Like, I think it's fine if they want to change the nature of the baseball or lower the seams or, you know, do whatever to kind of drive more offense. I don't think it's the perfect way I would improve baseball is make there be more balls in play, in addition to more balls in play, more balls in play that fall for hits. Since there's no easy way to do that, I guess fine, you know, increase the number of homers if you can, bring a little more offense, but I think it'd be more fun to see more doubles and triples. But I just don't think it's a big deal for baseball to say, hey, you know, we're changing things up a little bit. We're changing the nature of the baseball because we do it all the time. I just don't know why there needs to be a level of secrecy behind it. I'm also not convinced that the baseball is juiced. I mean, there's been so many different reports in different directions and that kind of thing, but I kind of don't care. I just want to – it would be nice to know what's going on, but it doesn't make all that much of a difference.
Can we just get back to talking about the canaries in the coal mine here? That seems very cruel to those little birds.
It's bad. It's bad. Yeah, it's we like to talk about birds on this podcast, so I figured I would throw another bird metaphor in.
Shake your tail feathers.
It's just all reality TV. You can't turn away. The more level of secrecy, the more like reports that point in a direction, and the more MLB tries to kind of shoot them down. It's reality.
There's a little known clause in our contracts that once Brody references it's reality TV, that means the show must end within the next 2 minutes. Otherwise, we all get fired. So
that's right. That's right. Word. The only reality TV that anybody is allowed to bring up on the show is the wonderful slate of programming on CBS, which you can find many evenings.
That and Ghost Adventures. That is it. Tune in to Big Bang Theory, Superior Donuts, and the best new drama on TV. Where are the baseballs juiced? I can't even talk now because of this. My goodness. Get us out of here, Brian.
All right. Thank you so much for listening and making it to the end of this show. We are DFA Podcast. You can find us on Twitter at DFA Podcast. You can find us on iTunes, on Stitcher. If you could drop us a rating and a review, we would appreciate it so much because I'm not sure anybody else has done it yet. you can find RJ at CBS Sports. You can find Sean on television.
In the Big Brother house, yes.
You can find him at BP Mets. You can find him at Sabre Seminar this August. You can find him at Beyond the Box Score. You can find me at Baseball Prospectus once in a while. And you can find the show at Baseball Prospectus as well. I'd like to thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much to Sean and to RJ for talking about baseball with me once again. Have a good evening.